Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. This is a discussion, in conversation with Tom Steyer, organised by the Global School of Sustainability. It's an enormous privilege to have you with us, Tom. Thank you so much for coming. I'll say just a few words about where you've come from, but then I'll actually ask you to articulate where you've come from, and then I hope we're going to have a lot of discussion about where we're going, what the problems are, but how we can work together to make it all happen, or give us a chance of making it all happen. The Global School of Sustainability is your host this evening. Tom is going back tomorrow morning early to California for a gubernatorial debate. Tom is running for governor of California. We are not a political organisation, but we wish you well. but it's very good of him to have proceeded with our event here tonight in the context of the scheduling of that, which of course came up well after we had already organised this one. So thank you so much, Tom, for that as well. Now, Tom's had an amazingly successful career as an investor. I mean, he did the usual bit of Yale and Stanford and so on, and then set up Farallon Capital, which is a very successful investment instrument manager of billions of dollars, and that worked very well. But a dozen or so years ago, he left that, profitably he left that, and became a person who devoted his life to climate action, sustainability, and so on. In many ways, through campaigning, through his own political activities, as an investor, and indeed as an author. We recommend to you Cheaper, Faster, Better, which got to the New York Times bestsellers list. So that's the way that's the life that Tom has been leading over the past dozen or so years, and he'll tell us about it. I've already mentioned that he's running to be governor of California. But also, Tom, having told us or touched on what kind of thought processes, experiences took you to where you have spent these last dozen or so years, also we could look ahead, because we face a world that is, to put it mildly, not easy. We have policy reversals on a huge scale in the United States. On those policy reversals, I should just mention that Tom also in 2017, during the first Trump presidency, helped organise a campaign for impeachment. As I learned to say in the Treasury, we couldn't possibly comment, but good. Tom, we live in a world which, in Mark Carney's language, we've seen ruptures, we've seen international rule of law fall apart, not to mention rule of law internally. We've seen trade rewritten. We've seen aid cancelled across a whole set of activities for the United States. And of course, the difficulties of this kind of approach to trade and aid are not confined to the United States. Those things are happening across the world, together with some reaction against climate action. Some going so far as to call the science a hoax. So we're in a more difficult position in many ways than we were just a few years ago. Many of you are probably, how many people have read Mark Carney's speech at Davos? Yeah, that's pretty good. High level awareness at the London School of Economics. And he spoke of rupture. He spoke of middle powers forming coalitions of different kinds across different issues. There's trade, there's investment, there's finance and aid. There's security, as well as climate and sustainability. Is that a realistic path? Does it make sense? Are there other ways? So, Tom, I hope you could reflect on a stranger world than we might have wished for just a few years ago. But still, we've got to get on with it. So how do we do it in those circumstances? Is Mark's sense of direction helpful? Are there others? It would be wonderful to hear your views on that. So, Tom, welcome again. Please tell us how you got here, and in this rather difficult, strange world that we now live in, how are we going to go on? How are we going to make things happen? Thank you, Tom. Tom, just before you start, I should just say who's on the platform with you. It's an in-conversation. I mean, you're the big draw, Tom, but there are other people here. And we have Larry Kramer, who's the President, Vice-Chancellor of the London School of Economics. That's where we are, of course. We have Jonathan Pershing, who is the inaugural Dean, the new Dean of the Global School of Sustainability. And we have Susanna Morato, who is our Vice President for Research. And they're all full of questions, so as soon as Tom has spoken and perhaps picked up on the question which I put, we'll ask the others to pitch in with their questions, and then we try to allow a good half an hour for your questions. Thanks very much. Over to you, Tom.
So I want to thank Nick Stern, not just for being so polite to me, but for a lifetime of work. Very well done, very well known in the United States of America as someone who's been a leader on environmentalism and climate around the world. And really, I'm super grateful to him. In addition to him being a nice guy, he really has been an amazingly effective guy. So,
thank you, Tom.
And I want to say to the two guys on my left, who are exiles from California, they claim it was willing, but I'm not so sure. What people do not realize is these two guys have had an amazing impact on climate. When at the Hewlett Foundation, under their leadership, really made a difference of well more than half a degree Celsius. And that could be, we still don't really know how much. We know it's at least that much, which if you think in the context of a world that's a degree and a half hotter, half a degree is amazing, and it might be much more. Honestly, and it was done without any real fanfare. I think only people who were really involved in the climate movement were aware of what they were doing and how impactful it was. And, you know, we'll never have the counterfactual world that would have happened if they hadn't done the work. But I want to say that I'm very aware of what they did and very grateful and very impressed. Honestly, you should know that. I don't know Susanna, but I did have a short conversation with her, and I would be extremely rude if I didn't point out that if she wouldn't be here if she weren't terrific. So listen, how did I get here? I come from the most conventional background in the United States that you can come from. I mean, I grew up in New York. I went to boarding school. I went to Yale. I worked at Morgan Stanley. I went to Stanford Business School. I worked at Goldman Sachs, and then I started my own company. So how could I end up here, given that incredibly conventional thing where you would think at this point I would be spending as much possible time in Mar-a-Lago and, you know, and skiing in Aspen the other part of the time. So let me say this. So I, of course, like every person with a totally conventional background, don't think of myself as totally conventional. And so one of the things you should know is I really grew up playing a lot of sports. And that was probably the most significant emotional thing I did. I was the captain of the Yale soccer team, which doesn't sound like much to everyone in the world but me, which to me is like, oh my God, that's amazing. But I had a real sports attitude towards life, which was, you know, concentrate, work hard, be a good partner, be a good teammate, and try and win. And it wasn't a lot more complicated than that. And so when I came out of college, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I got a job, and then I did that, and I played it like a sport, like, let's try and win. And, you know, it wasn't conventional to leave Goldman Sachs in those times. In fact, when I left, they told me to leave within 15 minutes, that no one was ever to speak to me again or go to my wedding. It was super, super, super ugly until the guy who made me leave because I couldn't stand him, I was working for, went to jail, and then Goldman decided I was the greatest thing, and they'd always agreed with me. But I will say this. It really was, when I was building Fairline, I was like, I believed in markets. I believed in capitalism. I believe that being part of that system really was, the invisible hand really worked, and that we were inevitably doing good things, so that if we did it in a high-minded legal way, that was the right thing to do. And a couple of things changed. For one thing, I really wanted a bigger view of the world, and I stopped believing in markets. It's not like I don't see the strength of markets. It's not like I don't understand how powerful it is. And it's not that I don't like disaggregated decision-making, because I love disaggregated decision-making, which is why I like democracy. I just started seeing markets, the idea that there were perfect markets or fair markets, as being increasingly untrue. And that every time, and if you look at climate's just a market failure. I mean, people are allowed to pollute for free, and so they pollute their ass off. Yeah, but what we're seeing in markets is increasing market power by monopolies or oligopolies, and we're seeing basically people not paying the costs of their production but keeping all of the revenues for themselves at the expense of taxpayers and their fellow citizens. So that was one thing that changed, because I stopped believing in that idea, the Milton Friedman idea that, you know, you just let people compete and that's the best thing. That's one thing that changed. The other thing that changed, which is a little embarrassing to talk about, I called my mother when I was 30, and I said, you know, Mom, you're not going to believe this. I believe in God. And she goes, Sonny, don't sound so smug. A lot of people who are much more intelligent than you have believed in God. But I really did start to feel like I want a bigger purpose. I don't want, you know, money can't be the measure of life. And I want to feel like I had an impact. And I would say, in my family, I'm the only person ever who's worked for money. Ever. Everybody else was, you know, my grandfather was a research doctor who never made more than $2,800 in a year. And my grandmother hated him for it. But he was like, no, 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 you don't understand. I'm going to change the world. So I really felt like I want to take a bigger view. I want to include more things in judging impact. I don't just want to look at the bank balance. I want to look at the impact more broadly. And I think, you know, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, but you need to measure more things. So that's why I changed, is I felt like I'm going to die and I'm not going to have lived. I'm going to have lived on a computer screen with the numbers going up to the right, but who cares? I want to live feeling like I had an impact, or at least tried to make things better, that, you know, leave the campsite better than you found it. I mean, I know it sounds silly and old-fashioned and cliched, but I think that's the purpose of life, just so you know. That's what we're here for, in all the ways, for everybody. So the things that I tried to do were to push back where I felt that the market system was either destroying the natural world or was unjust to a great number of people. And I tried really hard, and I'm still trying really hard. That's my goal, is to try and have a system that works for the majority of people. And I will say, I'm going to try and make this shorter, because I know that we'll be discussing this in much greater detail, but we're seeing this gigantic disruption because the sort of libertarian, Milton Friedman-esque framework for thinking about the world is clearly failing. And I think Brexit is a measure of that, for sure. I think Trump is a measure of that, for sure. I think Mamdani is a measure of that, for sure. And I think people are just saying, and which I say all the time in California, 12 trillionaires and 40 million people who can't make rent is not a success. If success isn't shared, it's not success. And I think that that's very different from the system that has the people in the United States revolting against outcomes, revolting against process, very, very angry. And not just with the Trump administration, but very angry with the Democrats, who have a 23% approval rating. So we're seeing a disruption, a statement of this philosophy, this structure, this process, these outcomes are unacceptable, and we're not going to put up with it. And so where that leads is very much of an open question in my mind. I mean, I know where I would like it to lead. I know what I think is the right way for it to lead. But we absolutely need a different vision of what we're trying to create as a society in the United States and in California. I know that. And that's what I'm running on, honestly. And so when I think about what we're doing to the natural world that is absolutely, you know, absolutely similar to what we're doing in terms of equality. California is the richest state in the United States by far. It has the highest percentage of people in poverty. It has the greatest inequality. And so is that success? But that is the model that we're building, and that is the model which people are refusing. The last thing I'll say is this. The tech leaders in California, who 15 years ago were huge heroes, have an 85% disapproval rating. They have a worse approval rating than the oil companies, which is pretty hard to do. So when I think about what we're doing today and what I think about what I'm trying to do in general, it is to reformulate how a very productive society, a society which in many ways is very successful, can turn out something that is much more just and much more permanent, because destroying the natural world, you know, is not a great idea. And yet it's something where people are willing to do that for money. There absolutely are. And we're seeing it happen at breakneck speed. And in fact, people aren't even at this point in the United States, in an awful lot of the United States, even talking about that is considered, you know, stupid. Honestly, the best word I can use. So I'm very happy to be here with people who are thinking about the same things that I'm thinking about. And if we disagree, I think that's fantastic, because then we'll all learn something.
Tom, thank you very much. That was very inspiring and analytical. And given your assessment of the disruptions, the market failures, the social failures, the anger, the absence of a shared sense of purpose, and you spoke about California, but United States more generally, and not just the United States, could you say something about strategies, leadership, coalitions? How do we find a way forward? Because we've got to think it through if we're going to be successful.
So I do think we need a different vision, and I think for the United States, honestly, the fall of the Berlin Wall in its own way was a disaster, because I think for every other time in our history, we'd had some sense of national purpose of trying to do something important and good for ourselves and the world. And I think that the current way of thinking is just get as much money for yourself as you can at the expense of whatever you have to do. And so for us to do this, I think there are two things that are necessary. One is to remind ourselves of a bigger purpose, that it's not just money. That can't be the answer. That is a terrible, destructive way to think. And second of all, to build a coalition, which is, Nick, I think what you were asking me. And where do I think that coalition comes from? Look, the coalition, I think, is going to be pretty straightforward, which will be young people, for sure, who poll completely differently from people over the age of 40. I think it will come from labor unions, and I know that I say that at a time when a lot of people are skeptical about unions, but they really do represent working people, and I think working people have been dramatically disadvantaged in the United States over the last 50 years, really dramatically. And it will come from people who have a broader sense of the natural world. And I think that, you know, that is, and I think the last thing is for the people who remember that democracy is worth it. I mean, we are definitely under threat as a democracy. And I think Donald Trump said in 2024 to his supporters, this is the last time you'll ever have to vote. And, you know, Americans have a terrible history of thinking Donald Trump was joking. He was definitely not joking. He is definitely going to attempt to end democracy in the United States. Definitely. So I think it's also the people who decide that there is something broader about democracy and the rule of law and decency. And we'll see how that turns out, because there's going to be a lot of, I think that that coalition is growing, and I think it's way over 50%. And I think that it will be disruptive, and I think it will break a whole bunch of institutions that think they're sacrosanct and will never be broken. But I think between technology and a completely different vision of what we're trying to do, a lot of things that people assume are forever are not going to last 3 years.
So leadership around democracy, a deeper and broader notion of prosperity, ideas of community and acting together. Do you think that political leadership can deliver that?
You know, just to be, I am an American. I'm very proud about it. And it, traditionally in our history, when we're really messed up, when everything is wrong and the system is not working and people are despairing, people come through. So do I know exactly who that's going to be and how it's going to look and who's going to show up? No. But the tradition of the United States is, in the Civil War, you get a Lincoln. In the Depression, you get an FDR. You know, we traditionally have had people step up with a new vision, and that's the leadership we need right now. I really feel like there's no doubt that we're at that kind of break point, at that kind of crisis, and it's in multiple vectors, and it's very clear that the existing leadership has failed. And so we'll see. I mean, I'm a true optimist on this, and I think it'll be some, you know, Abe Lincoln, a guy who had been in many ways a complete failure and never done anything and turned out to be a great president representing the best of America. Do I think that will happen? I do. I think that, you know, that we're at a place where we all know we need that, and I think that exists, and so I think it'll show up. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Tom. Let's come back to the international side of things later in the discussion, because there's a corresponding set of questions on the international scale where the issue of coalitions arise in a very direct way, as well as vision and the kind of world we want. But, Larry, over to you.
Although I want to go back to the international side of things.
Well, why don't you take it?
And I do want to just observe, apropos that last comment, one of the things that makes this seem so difficult for people is we're not used to the way things work historically, so it feels like it's a long time. The McCarthy era lasted 7 years in the U.S. before people finally turned it around. The Civil War, we walked into it over a 30-year period. So it may take more time. It's, you know, so I'm kind of with you, but not sure. So the question I want to ask, sort of, let's assume that the U.S. remains broken. And I want to ask about the geopolitics aspect in climate specifically, but also more broadly. So we're looking at a period where the U.S. has abandoned all of its commitments around climate, and more than just doing that is actually aggressively seeking to expand the use of fossil fuels globally while wrecking the, you know, global multilateral system. So on climate specifically, I guess the question is, who's going to fill the gap? I mean, the only plausible player, it seems, is China. And the question is, can we count on China to pick up that mantle, move this forward globally? And if not, then who and how? That's one question. And then more broadly, can we accomplish anything without a functional multilateral system? So Carney's speech was, we're going to have to organize one. And we're going to have to organize one essentially without the U.S. Essentially, the world got addicted to the U.S. economy. It needs to wean itself off of it. Going cold turkey is always difficult. You know, is there any, how do you imagine the creation of a multilateral system that isolates or ignores or somehow gets the U.S. out of the way to begin to function? Or if not, then how, you know, how does that work? So those are the
Or coalitions around sets of issues.
But it's more than coalition. We need institutions.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's obviously not going to be the U.N., or not without some kind of major, I mean, if the U.S. pulls its funding from the U.N. disappears. So we really, the challenges of thinking about a global order without the U.S., which I think we need to do, how do you think about that?
So that's two questions. Let me ask the answer the easy question first, which is leadership and climate. I mean, my book, which I know you're a little late for this year's Christmas, but next year would be a fantastic Christmas gift, let me say that, to all members of your family. I think in terms of the technology around clean energy versus fossil fuels, it's absolutely over. And so all of Donald Trump's attempts to move back to the 1950s are not only misguided from an environmental standpoint, they're incredibly stupid, and they won't work. And we're not going back to fossil fuels. And there's a whole bunch of reasons, starting with the physics that combusting fossil fuels use up a third of their energy, which means they start at a huge disadvantage, and then it goes from there. So just in the physics of energy, fossil fuels are worse and cannot win. And what we've seen in clean energy is they're much cheaper. You know, I wrote cheaper, faster, better. Cheaper. The per kilowatt hour, solar and wind are much, much cheaper than fossil fuels. And with batteries coming down where they are, solar and wind plus batteries are much, much cheaper than fossil fuels without fossil fuels paying any of their, you know, pollution costs. So when we think about leadership, it's really a question of what can people do to stop the tide, which is inevitable around cheaper answers around energy and around transportation. And the answer is nothing. You know, and Trump's arguments around oil are incredibly stupid because the United States already is the biggest oil producer in the world. We produce more than Saudi plus Russia put together. We're also the high cost producer. So who thinks that being the high cost producer of a commodity whose demand, every part of whose demand is under attack, that that's a good strategy for a country? That's an incredibly stupid strategy for a country. So when I think about who's the leader, look, the leader is China. There's no debate about this because it's not only the leader in terms of producing solar panels and wind turbines and batteries, it's also the leader in producing cars. And, you know, I think most of us, and I know I am, are barricaded off from buying Chinese EVs. But just so you know, a Chinese EV for less than $20,000 is as good as a Lexus. And the reason that we're barricaded off is because everyone would want them. So it's over. Like, can the U.S. barricade itself off? Maybe. But they can't stop Canada, Australia, Europe, Africa, South America from buying those cars. And they're going to, and China's, it's like compete or die. And if you think that going back to internal combustion engine cars from the 1950s is competing, I think you're delusional. So I think there's no question who's the leader. I don't think there's any question the way it's going. The technology is here. Tech is not the problem here. We can do this as a globe. There is no question. The issue is how fast can we do it and how much can the status quo oligarchs put roadblocks in the way of progress? That's actually the question around climate. In terms of multilateral systems, boy, I'm going to say that's over my pay grade. The ability of, you know, I think, you know, when and there are people on this stage who know approximately 1,000 times more about this than I do. But if we think back to the Paris Accord in 2015, which was maybe the landmark climate win, it really started with bilateral negotiations. Yeah. It started with U.S., China, and it was like one by one countries were brought in. So when I think about how we're going to organize around issues, I feel as if, to a very large extent, we can do bilateral, and then maybe we can add people, but we're watching the big institutional multilateral organizations in this world be devalued. And so, again, I started by saying this is over my pay grade, but what I can see can happen is India, Canada. I can see, you know, people getting together around issues and making deals that are real and that change the world. And if you think about climate, the world's changed because the global south is now where it's at. And so to a very large extent, watching how that works and watching how each one of those, the climate outcome is going to be written in Asia. And so watching how each of those major five countries that are going to be writing this, who they align with for technology, who they align with in terms of trade, is going to really be incredibly important. And I think, you know, Donald Trump can say whatever he wants, but the truth is that's where the outcome is going to be written. And they're not doing it on fossil fuels. That's so dumb. This is going to be technology driven, and the technology is going to get a lot better. And it's happening already. I was talking to a young woman today from the LSE from Pakistan. Pakistan added 50% more energy in 1 year without going through their utility or their government. It was just the tech's cheap and we don't have energy. And that is a, I think that what we're seeing is that kind of disruption where it's like the people up here are talking and the people down here are doing, are making it actually happen on the ground.
Yeah, you've got the technology and the politics coming together. The relation, I've worked a lot of my life in India and China, and the relationships have been terrible. But, you know, Donald Trump has begun to bring them together. You got a free trade agreement signed last week between India and Europe, which has been on the table for years and years and years. Suddenly it gets signed. I have to do it. But, Jonathan, I want to bring Susanna in a moment on some of the natural capital issues, but the bilateral agreement between the United States and China ahead of Paris, you know, we all remember a year before President Obama and President Xi Jinping speaking. You were very much involved with that, so I'd be very interested to hear your reflections on not just that event, but the broader story of how the world's powers of all kinds can come together.
So thanks very much, Nick. And Tom, it's really great you were able to make it. Thank you so much for making the trip. It's an interesting question to think about. So I was one of the people who helped draft the language between the U.S. and China during that negotiation. And then I was also involved in the Paris negotiations as the U.S. climate change envoy. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is I think Tom's right in the sense of this buildup between a couple of key players, which ultimately could have made or broken the global agreement. But it wasn't sufficient. So there actually had to be a whole series of other things that happened at more or less the same time. I give the French enormous credit, and Laurent Fabius, who was at that point the foreign minister, and his team, for really kind of creating a sense that this was possible. And it was possible in a multilateral moment where people still thought that those institutions were central. And it was within that institutional arrangement that the U.S. and China could do a deal. It's less clear that if you didn't have that multilateral context, the deal would have been possible. So let's kind of do a kind of a back thought exercise and think as to whether or not the Chinese and the Indians will find a solution that was the equivalent of the Americans and the Chinese. Not evident so far, not implausible, but certainly not at the moment the direction of travel. The EU, conversely, looking at arrangements both with India and also with China, is still hoping to hold on to the multilateral structure underneath which that might be able to move. And at least at a, let's call it more superficial level, the Chinese agree. They talk about the importance of multilateralism. The Indians agree. They talk about the importance of multilateralism. The EU actually invests in multilateralism. And yet the underlying ability to use those institutions to create the kind of change we did a decade ago looks at best threatened and at worst less likely. And so thinking about that to me is kind of a real question. And I think that there's pieces that I would look at in both dimensions. And you've talked about some of them, but I want to bring back a few technology pieces that you've raised. So in my mind, I don't think there's much disagreement if we look not just at the price, but who controls that structure. It's basically Chinese. With the notion that a three-wheeler currently is even cheaper in India than it is in China, so it's not the United States on either of those, or Europe. Having said that, there's a set of other technologies that may, in fact, not yet have been fully developed, and those may come from completely different places. I want to put two before you and see which way you might approach the two of them. They're both in your book. One is the issue of agriculture. It's an incredibly tough issue. We actually don't really know how to manage it. There's a technology gap that we've got. There's certainly an implementation problem we've got. There are questions around the impacts of climate on that structure. You've done some really, really interesting work, both you and your wife, in Structures of California around sustainable agriculture. So I'd be curious to hear how you play that one out, maybe much more disaggregated than not. And the second, which actually might require much more aggregation, is carbon capture and storage. And the whole question, which you've also commented in your book, around sequestration, which is the capturing of carbon dioxide, both from the atmosphere and from various industrial activities. And yet, if we think about that, well, small players might make a difference at a global scale to get to the numbers we need, kind of have to go back to a multilateral arrangement, or at least a multi-country arrangement of significant players. So I'm curious as to how you might approach those two combined technical and political questions.
No problem. So agriculture, I mean, you should know that we own a small ranch, which is 2,000 acres. And we've been raising animals there for 25 years with scientists living on the ranch so we can measure the impact in all the multiple ways of changing the way we raise animals, both in terms of the health of the soil, the health of the animals, the capture of water within the soil and retention of water within the soil, the CO2, because obviously a lot of people think that cattle are terrible and, you know, they're a big part of the reason we have a climate problem in the first place. So we've really wanted to see what we could do to end up with the best outcome. And basically we're proponents of what's called regenerative ag, which sounds fancy and scientific and is super simple because it's rotational grazing. It basically is trying to mimic in the way that we raise animals, the way that animals live in the wild in the Serengeti. And that means they move around, they're different animals, they move in flocks, they tamp down the soil, and somehow they don't destroy the earth. In fact, it's one of the great breadbaskets of the world. And so that's what we've been doing, and our goal for a 2,000-acre cattle ranch was to see if we could influence in the United States 3 million acres in terms of how people raise animals, and we are at 14 million acres. So we feel like, at least in the United States, people are moving to this because it actually works better, and that what we've been doing in industrial ag in the United States, where basically the Department of Agriculture pays farmers to do exactly what they want, is to end up with a system which has produced massive amounts of food, it's true, but with massive side effects. And so the question is, can the world survive those side effects? And don't we, in fact, have to move to a much more regenerative way of raising crops and of raising animals? And the answer is, yes, we do. And so that's where we are, in the sense that I think that in terms of processes and technology, I think we're at the place where it's more productive and where you're basically rebuilding the health of the soil and the natural world. We could have a long talk about the ethics of raising and killing and eating animals. We could have a long talk about it. And we could have a long talk about the health effects of that on human beings. But I can say this, we will solve that. We have basically solved the methane problems out of cows. And I don't think we should spend the rest of our lives worrying that we can't do that, because there are multiple ways that we can do that and are doing it. So I feel, in terms of agriculture, we're going to have to change. And this is the most primitive change in the world. And the biggest problem with agriculture, this is the last thing I'll say, is this. If you want someone to change what they're doing, they have to be able to afford to make a change. And most farmers are really poor, including in the United States. So anytime you want to sell them something, in order to sell someone something, they actually have to have money. I mean, because if they're not paying for it, it's not really a transaction, right? And around the world, the biggest issue we have is about farmers don't have money to make the changes they need to make. That's the simple fact. But the second thing was about sequestration. So I'll give you, some of this is controversial, just so you know. I have a very strong opinion about this, which is we have to do sequestration. We have to do it big. We have to do it as soon as possible. And it is not something that's going to prevent people from reducing their emissions. That in fact, measuring emissions and measuring sequestration puts us in a place where we're going to get the best answer the fastest way. That is something which not everybody believes, but that's something I really deeply believe, partially because we haven't reduced our emissions and we have the ability to sequester in multiple ways at the gigaton level before 2030, which would really change the trajectory in terms of CO2 emissions. So we have to do it, and I also think it's the right thing to do. Having said that, the two big ways to do sequestration are mechanical, big machines sucking CO2 out of the air, putting it in a pipeline and then putting it in caverns or used up oil fields, and natural world, where basically we use photosynthesis in one way, shape, or form, basically to suck CO2 out of the air and stick it in the ground. And just so you know, I have a really strong opinion about this too. The mechanical stuff does not work, does not scale, is way too expensive, is a joke, honestly. And it's just the numbers. If it worked and were cheap, I'd be all for it, I guarantee you. I mean, I'm Mr. Cheaper, Faster, Better. The natural world stuff does work. There are multiple ways that we can use photosynthesis to take CO2 out of the air and stick it into the ground or into the ocean. And that is what we're going to have to do. And it does exist. It's very technological. It's very doable. We really can do this. And I think this will be, if I'm right, this will be an unannounced, huge step forward in terms of bending the curve, in terms of net emissions. And so I will say that for somebody who I know, these two guys both know, Steve Chu, who used to be the Secretary of Energy and is a Stanford professor. Basically, just to give you some numbers, and I'm going longer about this because I care about it, but if you assume there's about 40 billion tons of CO2 emitted a year, the assumption was by 2050 we would have to sequester 10 of those 40, so a quarter. And what Steve said to me a year and a half ago was, the 10 is low. It's going to be 10 to 20. So the idea that we shouldn't be moving at warp speed on sequestration, the issue is payment. And that's exactly what Jonathan was bringing up. We have to have a, we can do this in India, we can do this around the world if we pay people to do it. And so having a multilateral system or having a system where it's recognized so that somebody in rural India is getting paid, it's being measured, and they're getting paid cash money is absolutely critical for this. And I think that having said that, that those systems are easy to imagine. People have to be willing to do them and understand that this is an amazingly cheap way to solve a huge part of this problem.
Thank you very much, Tom. I mean, if you just did some mental arithmetic, I mean, suppose you were capturing 10 billion in mid-century, and suppose it, that cost you $100 a ton, yeah? Then that's $1 trillion in a world GDP then, which might be 200. It's peanuts, if you excuse the metaphor. And of course, if you can get it down well below 100, which a lot of the natural ones can be, yeah, then it's still cheaper. But the combination of agriculture and natural sequestration takes us straight to what Susanna
does. Before Susanna comes back in, I do think it's an interesting debate that's underway on the mechanical side. So just to put the other piece of the equation on the table, we're now looking at numbers that are also at about 100. So if that's true and it continues to come down, it still nicks trillion. And so the open question that we probably will ultimately debate is, does the speed, the other two parts of your framing, does the speed with which that might be accomplished exceed the speed of the natural systems? And I think that, frankly, is a bit open and depends a bit on price.
So let's talk about price for one sec, just so you guys, and maybe you guys all know this, but basically the way to think about the cost per ton, oh gosh, we're in the UK, sorry. Well, I can tell you this. Gasoline in the United States costs somewhere around $3.50, say. And $100 a ton is $1 per gallon of gas. So if you think about that as a tax, $1 on $3.50 gas, I guarantee you Americans would pick up all of their guns and kill whoever proposed that. I believe we'll get it much lower. Just so you know, in the natural world, I think this will be below $25. So do I believe that we can afford a 25-cent equivalent tax on oil and gas? I really do. And I think, you know, we'll see. But I just think I'm not opposed to mechanical. I'm just told by the engineers who I know and trust the most that it doesn't scale, that we'd have to rebuild the whole oil and gas system several times over in order to build that system. And I think the natural world is a place where actually let's use God and photosynthesis to get this done cheaply. But thanks. I mean,
so Susanna, over to you on the natural world.
Thank you. So I want to come at this at a slightly different angle, which is focusing on nature, biodiversity, and ecosystems, which you've already referenced. So they normally sit outside the mainstream debates on climate change, but they are, in my view, absolutely central to how climate risks are actually experienced by people. People might not care about net zero, but they will care about their local the food prices, their flood risk, the way their natural landscapes are changing, and the pollution in their local rivers. So this is something that resonates with people. And moreover, it's so nature can help get support for the climate debates. But moreover, the UK government just published in the last few days a report that links global biodiversity loss and ecosystem change with national security. And it's quite scary reading. They talk about how every major ecosystem is now on a pathway to collapse. And that could lead to food insecurity, water scarcity, pandemic risk, migration problems, but also conflict and geopolitical pressures around resources. So this is no longer just an environmental issue. It's actually a national security risk. And one of our colleagues at the Global School of Sustainability, Nicola Ranger, she talks about nature being too big to fail, because if nature fails, economies collapse. So this is actually really really big. And I know you're keen on the nature aspect. You've just talked about your ranch. But should we be thinking about reframing the way we talk about climate change and how it impacts people and bringing nature, ecosystems, natural capital to the core of what it is? Because I think that would help, and would get people behind it as well.
So should we consider the end of the natural world as an important thing to bring up occasionally over coffee? Yes. So let's talk about it for 1 second, though, because there are reasons why this isn't as easy a topic to talk about as climate change. And it's kind of the conversation that Jonathan and I were having, which is, he was saying, look, Tom, there's a chance that we can do this mechanically fast at a price that's acceptable. We can measure it. It's permanent. So that's a real thing. So if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. But you can measure CO2. And so therefore, you can have all of those conversations. You can set up an international system to pay farmers around the world to sequester CO2. You can use satellite information with AI to look into the soil and get very close estimates of how much is being sequestered. So if you can measure it, you can manage it. That makes it easier. The numbers on biodiversity and extinction are truly, Susanna was saying it, and she was saying it pretty politely in my mind, they're terrifying. You know, I think the ones that got me were, in the US, 75% of the wildlife is gone since 1970. Three quarters of it gone. And if you go and look online, which I invite you all to do if you don't believe me, about how many of the species on Earth are predicted to be extinct by 2100. So that is 74 years away, which in geological time is not the blink of an eye. It's much less than the blink of an eye. The low range is 1 in 12 species will be gone, and the high estimate is 1 in 3. I don't even know what that means. I literally don't know what that means. But it's very hard to talk about, because it's very hard to connect, you know, sprawl, you know, habitat destruction, all the things that are actually causing species to go extinct, wildlife to disappear. It's very hard to measure that and connect it to the outcome. So the outcome is truly terrifying. But getting the connection between, you know, building a new housing project on a farm and just continuing to, you know, destroy habitats, it's very hard to make the connection and to do the measurement. So I think in this case, it really does take almost a value decision. It's very hard. And, you know, our society seems not to be able to grapple with anything except measurement and money. And climate, amazingly enough, is measurable, and you can put it in terms of money. And that makes it easier for people to think about it, honestly, and to therefore to control it and change it. And the issue here is you have to make a value decision that this is valuable in and of itself, and we don't exactly know how, and therefore we're gonna have rules. As running for governor, trust me, I'm talking all about, we need a lot of housing in California. I want it all to be dense. I want it to be around public transportation. I want it to go up, not out. Okay, but that's, you know, people are gonna have to be willing to make that, or else we're gonna have to do what we've done in climate, which is get the cost of that lower than anything else. But what we're seeing is habitat destruction around the world in pursuit of money. I mean, that's what the Brazilian rainforest is all about, is people who want to have a farm. And so they're going to cut down the rainforest and grow crops, and they're going to be richer as a result. And that's something that's going on around the world, and the impact of that in toto is one that is very, very frightening.
Thank you, Tom. Now, we'll go over to the audience, but before I did that, Tom, I just wanted to check, are there questions you have for us? You've got a bunch of academics here who might be able to be, or if you'd like to have a think and at some point ask us questions.
Well, let me say this. Just so you guys know, the people on this stage, not including me specifically, actually are central to us solving these problems. And so when I run my mouth about multilateral organizations, that's just some guy running his mouth. But when these guys are talking about it, they have worked in these, led these, constructed these, made them succeed. So that to me, honestly, Nick, the biggest question to me is around the structure. Because I think every country may do what it wants to do. But the real question is the question that Mark Carney asked, which is there going to be a structure where people are willing, the way Jonathan said, to buy into the structure and therefore to buy into the outcome because it's part of a structure that they trust? That to me is a huge question that the people on the stage know an awful lot about.
Thank you very much. And clearly leadership and politics are going to be absolutely central to all that. And that's what you do, and we try to help. But we're now going to go to you for questions. We've got a diverse audience, but being young is a very good criterion for being asked to offer a question. Now, can I just say, could you give your name when you and where you are? I mean, for example, I'm Bloggs from LSE. And then if you could keep the questions short. We're going to take three at a time. Far back there, I think the farthest back question. Yeah. Could you keep your hands up, please? We're going to take three. And then right at the end of this second row at the front, yeah, is number two. And then gentleman with his hand raised in the middle of that row back there. Can you keep it up? Yes, that's the one. Well, so we'll go through in that order, please.
Well, thank you very much. My name's Julian. I'm a student here at LSC, also an American, evidently. But I had two questions for you. First off, you know, you are hoping, and you know, I think a lot of people are hoping, that the United States re-engages more in the world in a way that is different from it's doing now. Do you see the United States? I mean, you've mentioned Carney's speech quite a bit. I mean, he was very critical of our influence in the world. Do you see us returning to the same place we were? Are you advocating that? And secondly, you know, it's a question which is a bit more domestic, but you're running for governor of California. So, you know, I want to know, I mean, what exactly would you say has been the biggest failure of, you know, on a statewide level in California? You know, and it's not a Trump thing, right? It's a pretty left-wing state, so I'm especially curious with that piece in mind.
Thank you. We're going to take three, Tom, and then come back to you, if that's all right. But please.
Hi, my name is Pooja. We first met in 2018 when you and your wife were singing back in SF when we had the Global Climate Action Summit. There was a nice like ping pong night. But
I hope
you guys are still singing.
I hope not.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask, so you were saying that, and also, you know, U.S. is at 250 years since independence, about double the school. But you were mentioning that we need a new type of leadership. If you could paint a picture of the type of leadership that we do need, that would be great.
Very good. And just at the back there.
Yeah, my name is Sebastian. I'm from New Jersey. I'm a student in the European Institute here, a graduate student. So earlier on you mentioned that the Civil War brought about Lincoln and the Great Depression brought about FDR. And I was thinking even Gilded Age kind of brought it about Teddy Roosevelt. But in today's world, it really seems to me as a a young American voter that very few people on the Democratic side are willing to kind of step aside and enable that change that we would be looking for, especially to excite a coalition like what you're saying with labor unions or young people. And if, I think especially in a post-Citizens United world, where you basically need billions of dollars to sustain a presidential campaign, I don't really understand where there could be an access point for a newer, less experienced candidate in that regard. And so I guess my question would be, how do we get people established in the political sphere to kind of accept it's time to step aside and kind of guide us not towards another election that feels like it's a lesser of two evils?
Thank you. I should point out there are students at the LSE who are not from United States. but we might pick up some of those in the next round. Over to you. Yeah.
Okay. The first question was, is the U.S. going to re-engage in the world? And is it going to go back to the same place? And then what's the biggest failure in California? I sincerely hope the U.S. re-engages in the world. I mean, I think that what we're doing right now is destructive and self-destructive. And I think that it's incredibly obvious. And I hope that we will stop literally shooting ourselves in the head on a daily basis. Will we go back to the same place? No. Nope. We are not going back to the same place. I believe we can go back to being a very constructive and positive force in alliance with other countries in this world, and I sincerely hope we do that. But the idea, I think the idea that the U.S. is the, to use a fancy word, the hegemon, was never a good idea. It's not a good idea now. It's not going to be a good idea in the future. And I think that the arrogance implied in that is something that has been a negative for the world, and I think that Donald Trump is the result of that attitude. And so I'm very much hoping that actually we're going to go to a much more disaggregated decision making with more people involved and with the U.S.'s voice being, less dominant, less arrogant. Biggest failure in California? Economic justice. I always say the problem Californians have is they can't afford to live in California. And that's really true. I mean, it sounds funny, but it's not funny at all. Basically, we're in a situation where over half the people really cannot make rent, cannot, get past living paycheck to paycheck, don't think they'll ever be able to buy a house. And really what we have is massive inequality, and it's not acceptable. I gave some of those statistics earlier, but it's really not acceptable, and yet it's the system that we're producing, and there are a bunch of people who are fighting to preserve that system and that inequality and see no contradiction in it. And I think that that's the biggest failure, and I think that, our system, people are allowed to give money in political system, in our political system, and they're allowed to give unlimited money through political action committees. And they're going to do it in this election, not for me, I assure you. And that's a way to distort the political system in a way that is, in my mind, completely antithetical to democracy. So that is our biggest failure. New type of leadership in the U.S. and I think disruptive leadership is by definition unexpected. And I think the idea that we were going to get a Muslim mayor in New York City was not expected. And I think that actually he didn't have all the money behind him. In fact, he had none of the money behind him. And I think that there is the great thing about social media and, the web is that you have an ability, if you have something to say, to blow up. And in fact, that's what I think is going to happen, is that spending money on TV, which is the big expense, that is kind of over. And so in a sense, spending money is a little bit over because it's really going to be about what happens online. And so I expect people to blow up. Look, Donald Trump's really good on Twitter. Let's face it. He really is. It's a medium that really suits him and which he has exploited to great success. Mamdani was really good online. So what we're really, I think that the good news about technology is it basically gives everybody a shot. And it's sort of a weird way, but who is going to blow up in that shot? Like, did I think the Kardashians were going to blow up? I actually did not, just so you know. I don't understand it, but so I...
They would blow up. Yeah.
And the last question is, will old leadership step aside? I'll say two things. The first one is no. The second one is, everybody recognizes that. So Rahm Emanuel is running for president. He's the former mayor of Chicago. He was a congressman. I think he was the...
Chief of staff
to Obama. So he's had, and he was the ambassador to Japan. So he's had a bunch of jobs. And he's running on, everybody has to resign at 75. The Supreme Court has to resign. The president has to resign. Everybody has to resign at 75. So it has not escaped the attention of Americans that we have elected a bunch of people who are past their sell-by date, if you know that. Because it's really true. And so, but the willingness of people to give up their entitlement, their power, the attention they get, we've seen they ain't willing to. So it's going to be a combination of people realizing how devastating it is and people actively bringing it up. You know, we had a California senator who ran for Senate a six-year term at 86. And everything bad that you think could have happened, happened. It was just too old. She couldn't do it. And so I think people are realizing that. And I think the willingness to be polite about it is over. I think from now on, everybody is going to be like, no, we can't have this again. And I think, will they step aside willingly? Absolutely not. But will they be forced to step aside? I think, yes, they will.
Larry, do you want to come in on
that? Yeah, I just want to add a couple points on each of these. So, you know, on the question whether the U.S. returns, it's not actually going to be up to the U.S. And to be honest, I'd be surprised if it does, because I can't imagine any country in the world ever trusting the U.S., not for a long time, only because you just don't know if in the next election the voters who voted for Trump twice are going to elect some other crazy person. And so you really, I mean, honestly, it would be very hard to trust the U.S. So if the country is to come back into being a constructive player in the global order, it's going to have to be in a very modest, very kind of subservient way for a while until the country can actually re-earn some trust. I actually, on California, the point that I would have also underscored, just because people won't realize this, Tom obviously knows this, and Jonathan too, what's so striking about California, once you get off the coast, you are talking about a kind of poverty that is devastating. People won't have running water. People don't realize the depth of the in economic inequality in California is really, really profound. On the leadership that we need, I think my answer would be, for the U.S. in the short run, for the rest of the world, I think more increasingly is the next generation leadership we're going to need is not disruptive, it's constructive. So the disruptive leadership has wrecked all of this, and we're not going to get out of it unless we have people who can figure out how to constructively rebuild both coalitions and institutions. And if we don't have that, you cannot govern without institutions. There is no way to do it. When they're broken, it may be that you need to break them down, but you have to rebuild them. And that's what I think we're going to need next. And then to the student who raised the question about leadership, I mean, the really interesting thing about U.S. history is how lucky the country was for so long. So it's not just Lincoln and the two Roosevelts. I mean, George Washington, who was well-known as a leader, obviously, when he became the first president, never turned out to be perfect for that role in a way that nobody could have understood at the time. Lincoln really does come out of nowhere. Roosevelt only shows up because McKinley gets assassinated. And FDR was a complete surprise to everybody. So, you know, part of, you know, if we get lucky again, maybe, but you can't count on it. But you can't take the fact that you can't see the person now as the reason to think that there isn't such a thing, because almost always those kinds of leaders surprise people and come out of nowhere.
Thank you, Larry. Now we're going to take three more questions. Lady just by the wall there. Yeah, it's number one. And this gentleman right at the front here.
He's looking for somebody very non-American looking.
And then the person just behind you. No, you're not number one. The number one was over there. And then you're two. And then just this one here. Yeah, the white jumper there. And again, please say who you are.
My name is Aurora. I'm also another American from California.
How am I supposed to tell?
master student here at LSE. And I wanted to ask a little bit about environmental rollback, because in California, it's not all because of Trump. Governor Newsom enacted a pretty aggressive new drilling law last year at the end of session. So curious what your thoughts are on that. But more broadly, there's this stalemate globally, but maybe focus in Sacramento, around this kind of cost of living crisis and environmental action. And the narrative has really been taken by the Republicans and by WISPA. And so curious what your thoughts are on kind of squaring that circle around climate action and the affordability crisis.
Thank you. Please, you're next. You got the mic?
My name is Michael Sinclair, and I coordinate the Deliberative Democracy Collective in a movement for democracy in Europe called DiEM. The problem, as I see it, is with political parties, the constitutional nature of political parties. And all over the world, what we are dealing with is adversarial politics. We never, for 1 minute, hear true shared deliberation in our parliaments. We never hear expressions of doubt. And until we achieve some sort of constitutional change within our party politics, we'll always be run by these systems. Would you agree?
Okay. Thank you. And then lady just behind you.
Hi, my name is Mira, also an American, also a student here at LSE. So I'm a California voter, so I'm curious, as you're running for governor, what is your expected environmental and climate policy specifically for California, and how are you going to manage to do that with the federal administration that might not necessarily agree with you?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
I'm just trying to get that all down.
So no.
Just want to make sure.
We approve of careful note-taking at the LSE.
So it starts with environmental rollback. Climate action versus affordability. I mean, I did write a book called Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We Win the Climate War. Because I don't think, what I've observed over the last 20 years is asking people to sacrifice on behalf of climate is very hard. And I've never believed in the green premium. I just don't think that's how it works. What I do think works is the fact that these cost curves have crossed, and that therefore the clean alternative is cheaper, faster, and better. And it's not just in the most basic stuff like solar and wind and batteries, but it's across the board in terms of heat pumps and all the different ways that we can use technology to basically reduce energy use, make things much, 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 much more efficient, and do things like sequester carbon in the ground and be able to measure it. Because if you think about it, if you have to actually go out and measure it, it's way too expensive. You've already lost the war. So I don't believe that we can get people to sacrifice. And I do believe that the technology is at a place where we should just be rolling these people up. And really, they're pushing back politically. You know, they're not pushing back on the basis of anything except, you know, kind of power, not on economics, and that they think they can hold back, you know, they can keep selling stuff that's more. I mean, LNG is a perfect example. LNG is really dirty, you guys. I don't know how many people know that, but LNG, soup to nuts, is probably about as bad as coal. So when there are a bunch of ways they kind of describe it as somehow better, which is not true. And so to a large extent, it's just a very expensive, very dirty fuel. And the advantage to it is, you know, you can use it all the time and it's not intermittent. Okay, I get that. But the truth is, We are going to solve that technologically. So I think the way to win, I hate to say it, is cheaper, faster, better. And then I think, and then you're going to have to politically beat down people who have an enormous amount of money and an unlimited willingness to destroy the world. That's what I think. In terms of structural change and deliberative democracy, people seem as if they're willing to do just about anything and say just about anything, regardless of whether it's true or not, and to use the media I think a big part of this, to take a step back, I agree with what you're saying, that in fact we're not getting the information as citizens in a way that it's really usable and trustworthy. And I think a lot of that has to do with some of the rule changes in the United States, which is the only country I really know that much about, but also basically social media leads to that. And so we've gone to a different form of information dissemination, which is not based around the absolute necessity of accurate information being sent to all the citizens so they can be good citizens, but is often very much knowingly dishonest, deceitful, and inaccurate in order to win a point. And so to me, an awful lot of this is about the ability, the capability and willingness to lie all the time through social media with no edit function, and where people are not getting the same information. The last thing I'll say is this. So I was coming out of church, and this 85-year-old friend of mine, who's a woman, who's a widow, said, can I talk to you? My daughter won't talk to me. Do you think I should stop watching Fox News? And the point being, she's getting a completely slanted version of the world that her daughter doesn't share. So there's no ability to talk because they're really getting very different information. And so they really can't cross over. And I think that that's exacerbated in social media, where basically all of those things are designed to get you angry and to play to your, emotions, and to send you the information that will do that, not the information that would give you the other side of the story. And so to a large extent, to me, this is about information dissemination. California climate policy. What am I doing? Okay, here's what I'm doing. Not talking about climate. And you can say, Tom, that's completely unfair. You should absolutely be talking about climate. But here's what I'm talking about. Electricity monopolies and electricity prices. Insurance rates on houses because of the fires. This is something which is absolutely kitchen table issue. Land use. We need to build a lot of houses. And there's a real question about where and how to do it cheaply. And so in every one of these, do I think of that as a climate issue? I think of everything as a climate issue. I think the idea that it's somewhere off to the side where we make climate decisions and then over here we, burn rubber. No, I think that at this point in our lives, we're on a trajectory where electricity should be thought of as a climate issue, and getting to a place where we get the right outcomes is that. And so talking about the symptoms, the systems that exist that we need to change on a specific basis and why that change is going to be better for people. I say to people, we'll break up these monopolies and reduce prices by at least 25%. And they go, people go like, impossible. It's like, no, it's not impossible. And I could take you through those, but it's really numbers based. Land use, how are we going to build houses? What does it cost per square foot so that you can afford to buy a house? We're going to have to build houses differently, and we're going to have to talk about that. And there are people who don't want to build houses differently, who like building them the way they're building them now. So in every one of these, and in transport, it's really a question of, okay, what are we really trying to do? How are we really, transportation is the biggest source of emissions, just California by a lot. So actually doing the changeover is critical. And the question is, okay, it's the upfront costs and the charging stations. So if you want to talk about transitions to EVs, those are the two things you should be talking about. And to me, it's like, I can talk about those. And I know that the cost of EVs, which is the biggest hurdle, I think. Yeah, that's a hurdle. if you're not allowed to buy GPVs. But, you know, then the question is, okay, what are we going to do about those two things? And in every one of these, it's much more talking about how people's lives than talking about the globe.
Thank you, Tom. Now, I'm going to take three more, but it's going to work only if you are really quick with the questions. Not two questions, no clearing your throat, just go straight in. So, lady just near to you there, that's number one. And it's a gentle here, number two. And right over by the wall, number three, lady waving there, yeah? Please, really, really short. So, first one.
Thank you to Tom and the panel. Very interesting. Former Secretary of State John Kerry...
Could you speak, put the microphone a bit closer to your mouth, please?
Sure, sorry. Hi, I'm Liz Reynolds. I'm an urban planner with a background in sustainability as well. Former Secretary of State John Kerry of Galvanise has spoken about the political shift away from renewables as creating opportunities akin to leaving a $20 note sitting on the floor and going around scooping those up. So how do we cut through the noise to focus on those investment opportunities?
Thank you very much. Please.
Heike, I'm actually in agriculture, but my question is, you talked about the difficulty of connecting housing and the loss of nature. I'm wondering, is the disconnect a different one? And that's us thinking we're not part of nature, but we're above the natural environment, above animals. We're any different. We're a better animal. Isn't that the real problem?
Thank you very much. Thank you for the collective discipline, right far corner over there.
I'm Laura, and I'm an attorney, and I would like to know what is the role of race and gender in these coalitions and this change that needs to happen, and are we tapping into the intelligence and the experience that marginalized peoples have operating without a system and or just running around like, oh my God, the system that we have is broken?
Thank you.
Okay, short questions. I'll try and be pithy. John Kerry, about the investment opportunities. I can say this. John and I were in our partners in investing in clean energy and the kind of next, the transition from dirty fuels to electricity. And honestly, the results of that, which we've always said, this is, you're basically getting behind a gigantic trend that's not going to stop for at least 30 years, have been great. And so when he says it's like picking up a $20 bill off, I will say investing in clean energy over the last 3 years has beaten the indices very soundly, even though we invest in none of the big seven, which is half the gains in the indices. So we don't own Google, Microsoft, Tesla, NVIDIA, because they're not about clean energy. And so if you take that out, we're beating them anyway, but if you take that out, we're totally crushing them. And it's something which has been actually picking up steam and doing better in the Trump era, just so you know. So the fact is, this is a trend in the world that is unstoppable, which is the electric tech revolution. And it's going on. It's not going to stop going on because it's just so much better. And the fact that people argue about it is so darn irrelevant in the end. Are we part of nature or not? Obviously, we have decided that we are the lords of the earth, and that we will do with the earth and its other beings as we choose. And that is a, you know, obviously dangerous fallacy. And so to the extent that we separate ourselves from nature, we run the risk of moving to a place with a very dangerous place with very few species where we live online and we don't even live in the real physical world at all. And I think that that's the trend that we're on. And I don't know what that means, but I do know that the idea of separating ourselves from our own, you know, physicality, humanity, the actual parts of being a person and just living as someone who's on a computer screen is the reason I won't change my life, is I couldn't see that as a valuable, rewarding way to live a whole life. And so I'm very scared about that. And I think that that attitude is one which obviously I completely reject, honestly. Race and gender, great question. as we all know, women have been on the right side of this from the beginning, that the education of women is probably the number one change that pushes the world forward. I think that you can look all over the world and see in every place where women's education goes up, where their ability to be full citizens and self-determined is probably the single best thing in terms of progress, including climate progress. That's probably the best thing in terms of climate progress is the education of women. So do I think that they're addressed separately in the political context? Less so. But if you look at the gender gap in American politics, it's enormous. It is enormous, the difference between how men and women vote in the United States. I don't know if it's 20 points, but it might be 20 points, which is pretty incredible. In terms of race, I think traditionally American politics have felt as if non-white people, so black, brown, yellow, whatever cues you want to include in that, have been more, as a gross generalization, more progressive, more democratic, more change-oriented. That's been true. It's still true. I think, speaking for California, we actually are different from the rest of the United States on a race basis because we don't have a majority race. The highest percentage in terms of population in the state of California is Latinos. So we are a different state. We are much more the Rainbow Coalition. We have because we're on the West Coast, we have a much higher percentage of people who originated in Asia. And so, you know, do I think that traditionally people of color have been more progressive? I know that's been true. I expect it to be true going forward. And do I think that that's how it's going to be organized? To some extent, I do. I think, you know, you can never underplay race in America. I think it's becoming less salient. But, you know, I think it's also obviously true that the Republican Party is becoming an overwhelmingly white party, period, the end. And that a lot of the reason about that is the fact that we're going to be a majority-minority country, and to the extent that California is already, by far, a majority-minority state, means that in a funny way, yes, you can organize around race, but to a large extent, it's much more about income.
I'm actually going to give a quite controversial response that's quite different, but actually I think I can back with numbers. So putting aside, I think the first statements I would agree with in terms of what we should do, I think the reason Donald Trump is president today is because the Democrats spent so much time framing their issues in identity terms. And even the minority populations are tired of that. If you look at what happened in the last election, Trump got about the same number of votes he got in the first election. The Democrats, Kamala Harris, got 9 million votes less. There were two shifts reflected there, and they were all within the minority communities. There was gains across the board on the Republican side among blacks, among Latinos, among Asian voters, all across the board, and they're pretty substantial now. So it's still a majority, but they got something like 37% of the Latino vote. I think it was actually a little higher. They got a much higher percentage of the black male vote, almost none of the black female vote, interestingly enough, and so on. And then on the rest of it was explained by, again, within those same groups, people who just didn't vote. They weren't going to vote for Trump, but they just, what they heard from the Democrats didn't speak to them. So I think what Tom is doing in his campaign is still the right way to approach the issues, which is whatever group you're in, what people want to hear is they have perceptions of what are the problems in their lives, that I'm financially insecure. I can't count on being able to cover an expense if it's more than $400. How am I going to ever own a home? I don't have health care. That's what they want to hear. And that's true across the board within all of these groups. So there's a difference between what are the problems and what do we need to do to address them and the politics of addressing them. And the politics on the Democratic side, if they don't shift away from that identity focus, they're going to just continue to lose, as they have steadily been losing over the last several elections. Even in 2020, Biden won by running up the vote in a handful of states. The Democrats lost that election. They lost seats in the House. They barely got the Senate, under the most auspicious circumstances that any political party could have hoped to have. And it's explicable, I think, pretty clearly, and there's a lot of analysis supported by that set of issues. So I do think as I said, you want to distinguish between what the actual problems are and what you might need to do to address them, and whether the way to win an election and move things forward is to frame them in those terms.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Now, look, it's time now to do for me to thank you as an audience. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for the questions. That's clapping yourselves. You've got to do a bit better in what follows. Thank you to Larry, Jonathan and Susanna for being really splendid discussants. But most of all, Tom, thank you for being with us. You have vision and purpose, and you have strategy and practicalities that are thought through. And I was just trying to think of how many politicians one can say that of. But it's been a real privilege to have you with us. Thank you again for being here in the context of what you're going to do tomorrow in the gubernatorial debate. It's been wonderful to have you with us, and we hope that we can welcome you back often. Tom, thank you very much.
Subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.